coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A new University of Delaware study raises concerns about anxiety, depression, and substance use among LGBTQ plus adolescents.
What is most concerning is that it's beyond alcohol and marijuana and extending into cigarette smoking and also into prescription drug misuse, and that it is happening earlier.
We learn more about the results of the study and what they mean for Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about new affordable housing for seniors coming to Sussex County. Arts Playlist takes us to the latest Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery exhibition. And Enlighten Me introduces us to a UD student speaking at the latest University of Delaware TEDx event. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. About a quarter of Delaware youth identify as LGBTQ+, according to the Delaware School Survey. And a new study from the University of Delaware finds LGBTQ+ adolescents experience higher rates of anxiety, depression, and substance use. They're also more likely to report all three at younger ages than their cisgender heterosexual counterparts. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee recently sat down with UD Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Sciences, Eric Leyland, to talk about his study's findings and what they mean for the first state.
I know your study looks at data from 2022 to 2024. Can you tell me a little bit about what you looked into?
So the Delaware School Survey is administered in 5th grade, 8th grade, and 11th grade across the state of Delaware. It includes youth of all identities, so not just queer youth, but we did focus on the specific outcomes and experiences for LGBTQ youth across the state, and we focused on 8th grade and 11th grade. So a lot of this is about health surveillance and monitoring of substance use, mental health, educational performance, engagement in schools, access to basic needs. So it's really a way of monitoring and understanding the state of the land for health among LGBTQ youth, but in this survey for all youth, and then we just focused in on what's happening for the queer and trans youth specifically.
All right, and what's happening with queer and trans youth right now?
One thing that I think is really interesting from what we found, the rates of psychological distress and of anxiety are not great for youth generally, that we were seeing more than 50% of youth reporting experiencing recent symptoms of anxiety, for example, in 8th grade and 11th grade, and that's for all youth. But then when we start to look and say, well, how is it different or potentially worse among LGBTQ youth in the state, we see that those rates jump up above 75%, sometimes above 80% of youth who are saying, I have recently been feeling anxious or feeling distressed. And so that's not great. It's not great that 4 out of 5 LGBTQ youth in the state of Delaware are experiencing mental health symptoms. When a particular subgroup like LGBTQ youth have such an elevated rate of mental health concerns, that then is alarming for us as researchers, as clinicians, as legislators to consider what is going on that is harming these youth in particular, and where can we intervene to eliminate those disparities?
And what are some of the factors that are playing into these differences between queer and cis-hetero youth?
So specifically, we did see really elevated rates of psychological distress and anxiety at very concerning levels, so more than 200% higher among LGBTQ youth in terms of experiencing recent psychological distress. But they're receiving messages directly and indirectly from peers, perhaps from family, from teachers, from media, that are denigrating and putting down their identity. And that creates a cycle of distress that's hard for them to break out of, which contributes to these elevated mental health symptoms, these risks of suicide, and even this response to this distress by using substances more.
I'm interested in your take on what the differences were between your findings using the numbers from 8th graders versus 11th graders. And what does that tell us about queer youth and how their experience shifts and changes in that period?
So in terms of mental health, the disparities were about the same in 8th grade and 11th grade. So we didn't see too much difference in how many youth were experiencing anxiety and psychological distress around age 13 and around age 17. But where we did see more differences was in terms of substance use. And what we found is that the disparities were bigger between LGBTQ youth and their peers in eighth grade, which means that LGBTQ youth are starting to use substances earlier and at higher rates than their cisgender and heterosexual peers. So there's still disparities by 11th grade, but they're smaller, which we might expect that because more youth in general are starting to experiment and try substances and drugs. So it is concerning that LGBTQ youth might be initiating substance use earlier than their peers, because that can be a bit of a predictor of more problems in the future.
What's the difference between cis heterosexual eighth graders versus LGBTQ plus eighth graders in terms of substance use?
We see disparities existing between the LGBTQ youth and the cisgender heterosexual youth for all substances that we measured. So that included drinking, cigarette smoking, vaping, marijuana use, and prescription misuse. And the biggest disparities were in terms of cigarette smoking. So we see that there's about 140% higher level of cigarette smoking among LGBTQ youth compared to their cisgender heterosexual peers. And then like a 90% higher level of drinking, 120% higher vaping. It is not uncommon among teens to start to use these substances. But what is most concerning is that it's beyond alcohol and marijuana and extending into cigarette smoking and also into prescription drug misuse, and that it is happening earlier. That's what alarms me the most, that it's beyond the typical drugs that teens use and that it's happening earlier.
And these results, especially at this rate, with some of the numbers, you know, exceeding 100%, 200%, is that what you expected to find when you were in the middle of collecting data?
So based on the research that exists across the nation in terms of substance use and mental health, we did anticipate disparities. Some of what was surprising is how bad those disparities are, like how alarming that gap is between these groups, particularly because Delaware is generally a state that has a lot of the right policies in place for protecting LGBTQ people, including youth. And so we may have hoped that the disparities would be small or non-existent, but the data is pretty clear that both for mental health and substance use, LGBTQ youth are faring worse than their peers. And this is really recent data. This is from 2022 to 2024. So we're not looking at data from pre-COVID or even during COVID, when that particular social and historical stressor was leading to major spikes in mental health problems for really all demographics.
What kinds of issues are we seeing in Delaware despite having the right policies in place?
Yeah, so we don't have a formal assessment in this research of, let's say, for example, schools' abilities to administer their anti-bullying policies for LGBTQ youth. But what's really difficult to assess is like district by district, school by school, classroom by classroom, adherence to these policies. Because a lot of what happens in terms of the mistreatment of LGBTQ youth is subtle. It's not so much that a school has banned a queer youth from participating in an activity because of their identity, but it might be subtle mistreatment from a staff member or from peers that's maybe up to the teen themselves to have to be the one to document and report that this has happened. So it puts pressure on the youth. And I'll add too that one thing that we are observing is a higher percentage of youth identifying as LGBTQ. And in these surveys, we found that around 1 in 4 youth from the Delaware School Survey were identifying as LGBTQ youth. So sometimes I think when policies were formed in the past, we thought this is protecting like a small number of our youth to have inclusive curricula or anti-bullying policy. But what we found, and this did surprise us, is that nearly 25% of Delaware youth in this survey were identifying as LGBTQ. And often that's an underestimate in the survey because youth may not all be ready to check a box to say that they are gay or trans.
I understand there's not one solution here, but what do we do with this data? What do you want to see from schools, from families?
There is an answer that is focused on policy. Policy is one solution to improving the environment for LGBTQ youth, but policy takes time to form in committees, to draft, to vote, to reform, vote again. And so I think that there is room for some improvement to policy in the state of Delaware as far as it's focused on LGBTQ inclusion and curricula in schools in Delaware. So that is a place to start, but I don't think it's the only thing we should be considering, because schools and districts can make changes. Even teachers in classrooms can make changes without waiting for policy to mandate it. Some of the takeaway from this research is that we shouldn't be waiting until high school and college to be providing support for LGBTQ youth, because we see disparities by eighth grade already. So I think that middle schools in particular might need to start thinking more about the types of resources that need to be available for LGBTQ youth. There's also opportunities in classrooms to make sure that we have inclusive curricula. So when we're teaching about American history, do we teach about queer history? That's a part of American history as well. When we're teaching about literature, does that include highlighting that some of the authors that we read are LGBTQ? And then another thing that I think is important is opportunities for additional bystander intervention. And so we can train both peers and teachers and staff to be prepared to know how to respond if they observe the mistreatment, bullying, or discrimination of an LGBTQ youth.
Like you said, policy is one part of that. But the bulk of your answer had to do with how we can make these changes at the local level. Why do you think that's the way to go?
Yeah, I do think we need both. But youth interact most directly with their teachers, with their peers, with their family. And so the fastest and most direct way they will experience something different in their environment is from those person-to-person relationships. But even in environments where policy is lacking, families and schools can make more immediate efforts to change the environment around LGBTQ youth and provide those supports. And having peer support and family support are some of the strongest predictors of positive well-being for LGBTQ youth. Policy matters, but having those people in your life that support you is really what matters most for LGBTQ youth. So schools are a really important environment, but they're not the only environment. And in fact, we see from other research that parents have a really big impact on youth's experiences at schools, including LGBTQ youth. So even if a school might be a negative environment for an LGBTQ youth, supportive parents can buffer some of that harm by providing at least a home environment that's supportive. But what we find is a lot of parents aren't really sure what to do. And so they end up online trying to sort through resources or asking their teens, what should I do? And the teens don't always know what is needed either. So we're really working to identify how to support parents to support youth. We're trying to get some projects off the ground in terms of statewide affirming resources to teach parents how to be more affirming, to process their feelings as parents of LGBTQ youth, connect with other parents, and ultimately be more supportive, more affirming, and accepting of their teens so that those LGBTQ teens have a better home environment and better outcomes.
Thanks to UD Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Sciences, Eric Leyland, and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We learn more about a new effort to expand affordable housing options for seniors in Sussex County. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. More affordable housing for seniors is coming to Sussex County. CHEER recently broke ground on a project in Georgetown, bringing more low to moderate income senior housing to that area. Elected officials up and down the state have said for years this is one specific type of housing that's needed in the first state. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry sat down with CHEER's Chief Operating Officer Tom Reardon to discuss their project and where they go from here to attack this issue.
Tom, can you give us a sense of the need for low to moderate income senior housing in Sussex County, and if sometimes that need gets lost in a discussion of affordable workforce housing?
Absolutely. I think everyone knows the need. I think that the need is visible. I think it's intuitive. Everyone knows that the cost of housing is going up, and everyone knows that that impacts everyone. But yes, I think often we look at workforce housing, but we look at low-income housing, but sometimes we forget those seniors that are in that same boat. And I think that's a shame, because we have so many seniors that have worked to build this community to what it is, and now they can't afford to be there. And I think often they're overlooked because often they're alone. You know, we have so many seniors who live alone and don't really have a lot of communication with others, so it's easy to overlook. So we're really excited to bring these 59 new units online real quick, as quick as we can, so we have a place for those people who've given so much to their community already.
We're going to get to that in just a moment, but before, what's the interest in the existing housing stock? Wait lists, just any kind of request, and how did that inform your decision to pursue this particular project?
Well, I can tell you, CHEER already has a 60-unit senior housing apartment building here on our property in Georgetown, and there's a huge waiting list for that. People are often on that list for two or more years, and so clearly we can see just from that how great the need is.
What is the timeline for this first set of 59 units, and how long will it take to add the others to get to the 236 units? Is funding set, or are we still a work in progress there?
Still definitely a work in progress. Look, we hope to have these first 59 units occupied before the end of 2026. I anticipate construction being completed mid to late fall of 26. When will the other units start coming together? I don't know. The funding is not established for those yet, but we continue to work on it, and we know that this community has a lot of support for that, and we know that it will come.
When it comes to the funding, how do you acquire that? Is that some sort of partnership, county, state, private partnership? I mean, how do we go? How would you go about it?
The answer to that question is yes. It's all of the above. It really is. There are state funds, there are federal funds, there are county funds, there are town funds, there's, you know, private donors, there's businesses. I think everyone knows the need, and I think people generally want to help. They want to be a part of the solution, and so I think the people are eager to give, and we're so grateful for them, because they've done such an amazing thing here that's going to have such a lasting impact. So the answer to your question of where does the funding come from is simply yes. It comes from everywhere.
Is it easier to try to get the funding knowing that the governor, legislators, county officials, even the federal, the delegation, they're always talking about affordable housing? Does it help that you know that they're on your side here? It's just a matter of just trying to find where to get the money?
Of course. And I think that holds true not just for the the public money, but for the private donors as well. Everyone knows that there's a need. It's very easy to sell something when people can see the need and the outcome. You can see such a difference. You can see an immediate and real impact when someone has a place to live.
The apartments that are going up, what are they like? Is there a variety of offerings here?
Generally speaking, they're fairly similar. One-bedroom apartments with a living area, a kitchen with a little seating area, one bathroom. There's not a lot of variety in the apartments, really, but they're not mansions, but to the people that live there, it's the perfect place.
How do they compare to the units that are already there?
They're going to be very similar. The building is going to be very similar to what we currently have. In fact, I believe the footprint is almost identical.
What's the difference in age between the facility, the building you already have there, to now? I mean, is there like a big difference? Will you have to eventually update those to like match these? Or is it going to be, like you said, it's still just pretty similar? That doesn't have to happen.
I think they're pretty similar, and I don't think there has to be a lot. You know, we just invested in the existing building with new carpets in common areas, new painting. We've upgraded a few things. I don't think there's going to be a huge difference. Of course, you know, it's a newer building, and there's not going to be the scratches on the walls. The carpets are going to be brand new. There's going to be things. But generally speaking, I think we have worked hard to ensure that the housing that we currently have stays up to date and stays, you know, I think we're investing in some efficiency type things, so water efficiency, insulation in the current building as well, so that we're ensuring that we have the very best for everyone.
The need for the new administration and support services building, what do they currently offer, and how will this expand and improve services?
First of all, right now, our staff is split. We have some people in a building in one part of town, some people in a building in another part of town. This is going to bring everyone together, which I really believe is going to help a lot. I think it's going to help the communication. Yeah, we're very good at emailing each other and talking on the phone, but I think something is lost when you have, you know, one part of your team here and another part of your team somewhere else. You know, you don't get to sit down and have lunch with them. You don't get to, you know, have a time where you're just joking around. So I think that's going to do it, which I think is going to improve morale, which I think is going to improve our productivity. I think it's going to bring a lot of benefit to the organization in general. Plus, it will add more space altogether. So, you know, there will be more offices here in the community center that are available. It will allow us to do a lot more things here in the community center for the community rather than having us crammed into the small spaces.
And how important is it to have the services adjacent to the housing?
I think what it's going to do is it's going to make us have us be close to the people that we serve. And I think there's value to that because we get to hear them, we get to see them, we get to know what their needs are. And that's going to help us provide programs that meet actual needs.
What's been the reaction so far to this building, the groundbreaking, and the approval, and just now that it's going up?
It's honestly been a little overwhelming. A lot of people have called. You know, I think we know that there is a need for affordable senior housing. I don't think we expected as many phone calls as we've received already. How do I get on the list? How do I get an apartment? And so, you know, there's also been the positive, you know, everyone comes by and says, wow, I'm so glad that that's finally happening. I think everyone knows that the need is so profound that they're just excited that it's happening. But yeah, the response has been overwhelming. People need this.
When you see that type of response, whether it be from the people, whether it be from elected officials, how great is it for you guys to know that, you know, you seem like you're doing a good job and you're doing what you want to provide?
It's a great feeling, but it is a double-edged sword. When I hear so many people calling in, I recognize that there is such a need, and that's, listen, I'm excited that we can do this. I'm thrilled that we can make an impact, and I know that if we can impact even one life, it's worth it. But it just grieves me a little bit to see how many people are needing this, and that makes me want to get all of them done immediately. You know, I want to do all four of them. I want to build 10 more because I think the need is there. So it's great to know that we're doing something so concrete and so tangible that's going to meet such a need. But it's also a little heartbreaking to see how much more need there is.
Will you possibly maybe expand to either there or other places in the future, or is that just a wait and see to that?
I think I can accurately say that everyone at CHEER wants to do everything that we can. We have no plans beyond this at this point, and quite honestly, this is an ambitious plan that we have. So it is a wait and see. What I can say is that everyone on this team wants to do everything that they can. So could there be more in the future? Sure. There is no plan for it now, but I know everyone here will keep working as long as there is still a need.
Let's say somebody wants to either get on a wait list, or they just want to inquire about some of the low to moderate income senior housing. How do they do that?
Well, the best thing is to go to our website. We have a page just for this that is cheerde.com/senior-citizen-housing. I know that's a mouthful, but they can also call us at 302-515-0001.
Thanks to Cheers Chief Operating Officer Tom Reardon and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we check out the latest Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery exhibition. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware artist Kim Klaibe is known not only for her use of mixed media, including paints, wood, paper, and even wine and beer pours, but also for the diverse nature of her work. From the intense images of women in her show earlier this year, What About the Women?, to images featuring birds inspired by the poems of William Butler Yeats, Klaibe is always turning out new creative material. Her new show next month at the Delaware Division of the Arts Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington presents works inspired by the urban environment. And on this edition of Arts Playlist, Klaibe talks to Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny about her art and her approach.
Tell me a little bit about what we can see at the Mezzanine Gallery in November.
This show is called Urban Dwellers. So this is a subject that I haven't explored before. You know, I'm more of a beach person than a city person, but these subjects are somewhat abstract, but not entirely. They're I would call them abstract expressionism, and they, in my mind, represent the feel of a city or an urban environment. So it could be just the energy in the painting that has that kind of high energy city urban type feel, or it could be people in certain, walking in a certain way, dressed in a certain way. Some of them are critters, you know, squirrels and pigeons and things that you would see in an urban dwelling.
As you said, you are a beach person. What drew you to creating work about the urban environment?
Well, partly because it's in the mezzanine, not that Wilmington's a big city. I mean, I did grow up outside of Wilmington, but it is far more of an urban environment than where I have been for the bulk of my life. And I just thought, maybe I'll do something that kind of reflects the area where it's being shown this time, just to try something different. And I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. It's very different for me, but I like it. It's got good energy.
How many works are in the collection over at the Mezzanine?
I believe it's around 20.
And how long did it take you to put that together?
This is the end of October, so I would say I started working on those pieces in August.
Wow, so that's
I work pretty fast because I create a lot, so it's not necessarily that I'm working fast, it's just that I'm constantly in the studio, so I produce a lot.
Speaking of the studio, I want to ask you about what your creative environment is like. Like, what conditions do you really thrive in as an artist?
I think I thrive best in my studio setting. So I actually work now. I have two forms of working. One is an enormous easel. So if I'm working on a bigger piece and a piece that I want to spray water on so I get the paint to run and I can make a mess, I will work at a large easel. But I also have a vintage Coast Guard drafting table, and it's huge, and it's metal, and it's got the real heavy metal drawers on it. And I love, so when I'm working flat, then I will work on that big drawing table, and I just alternate between those two.
I wonder, do you listen to music or anything, or do you work in silence?
I don't usually work in silence unless I'm really overwhelmed, I'm overstimulated or something. But usually I either have music on. But I listen to Audible a lot because I do love to read. I love anything with the language. So many times I will have a book playing while I'm working. And I have to be at a certain point in my work, because when I'm coming up with the initial idea for the piece, I have to be able to focus solely on that. You know, I have to concentrate. So I can't have my attention diverted by even a favorite song. I've got to be focused. Once I get that kind of clicked in, then I can turn on the music, or I can turn on the book, and then it just kind of flows, and the two can kind of coexist together, which is kind of cool, because I can share my focus and it doesn't hurt the creative process.
And one thing I think is really interesting about your background, you studied art, but you also studied English. So I wonder what books are you reading and listening to now?
So let's see. So the last book I read was called My Friends. And I just finished that book, and it was from an author that I've never tried before. His name is Frederick Bachman. It's a novel, but it was a really interesting, creative kind of novel. So looking at my Audible list right now, it's nothing too brainy, but a lot of David Baldacci. I'd love Stephen King.
You talked about capturing the energy of the urban environment. And I wonder, how do you put that energy into a static painting? What are kind of the elements that go into creating that energy?
So with these pieces, here's what I love about these pieces. And I think it's going to also answer your question. I've never been an abstract painter. And I do think that a lot of artists, as they get older, lean more toward abstract painting. I don't know why that is. Maybe because you've tried everything else and you want to do that last. I don't know what it is. But so these paintings all start with an abstract. And then I take charcoal and I find the figure, the subject that I want to add on top of the abstract. So imagine a person's outline in charcoal on top of the abstract. And then I use a diluted acrylic paint and paint the area around the figure so it has a thin wash of acrylic paint. So the figure has the abstract coming through it, and the background fades into the background. And then I'll take water and spray the paint so it runs. And so to get the energy that you're talking about, it could be things like I'll drip paint in a circular fashion in the background or over the figure to kind of create a feeling of energy and movement. Paint splatters, cut paper to indicate a direction. Things that will kind of encourage the viewer to think of motion or energy or activity.
I want to ask, too, about one of your other exhibitions that was on display earlier this year, because I was looking at your work and I was absolutely struck by the work in The Center Cannot Hold, and especially the bird figures. What was the inspiration behind that collection of work?
That was William Butler Yeats, and his poetry is, that's some good stuff. And so I was rereading it, and he has a lot of bird imagery in his poetry, which you might not notice at first, but he's got many herons, he's got ravens, he's got all kinds of bird images. And as I was reading it, I was struck by that. So I started working in the birds. Like Easter 1916, there are a lot of his poems that really reflect, I feel, where we are today, culturally, socially, politically. All of those pieces were titled from words from his poems. And for instance, one of them was called A Terrible Beauty Is Born. So I tried to reflect kind of how I'm feeling about where we are in today's world.
When we talked earlier this year, we talked about an exhibition of yours called What About the Women? And I'm thinking from the gripping work that you did in What About the Women? And then the Yeats-inspired work of The Center Cannot Hold and now Urban Dwellings. Your work is so diverse. What's next? What's coming up for you now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I typically get to this point of the year where I consider it my post-show season. And it's kind of a time where I don't work a lot. I think a lot, but not actively think. I try to let images kind of come and go in my brain. I try to read a lot to see what sparks my interest. So frankly, I don't really know what's next. I'm waiting for it to come to me. And I'm sure it will. And I've had a few little things visit, but nothing has, and usually it comes up and it, you know, basically kicks me upside my head and I go, oh yeah, I gotta do that. So I'm waiting for that to happen. And the time between October and December is usually that kind of creative fertilization time for me.
It puts me in mind of plants that sort of go into hibernation and in the winter, and then they bloom out in the spring with something just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. And the winter is such a, not that I like winter because I really am not a winter person, but the good thing about winter is it is the time when I get a lot of work done because it is, you know, it's cold, it's nasty, it's dark. And so the studio is the perfect place for me to be.
Thanks to Delaware artist Kim Klaibe and Amar Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Klaibe's work will be on display from November 7th through the 28th at the Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington's Carvel State Building, with a reception on November 7th at 5 p.m. You can see more of her work at kimklaibe.com. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me, where we meet a UD student speaking at the latest University of Delaware TEDx event. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. TEDx, local independently organized branches of TED Talks, is once again coming to the University of Delaware. The roster of speakers for the upcoming TEDx session November 5th at UD's Mitchell Hall includes students, and their topics are typically informed by direct personal experiences. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale is joined by one of those student speakers, Junior Alexa Kate, a psychology major in the UD Honors College, to learn more about her talk, What If I Don't Want Recovery?, as well as her personal history with overcoming an eating disorder.
My first question is how everything came together where you became a speaker at this upcoming TED Talk. It's my understanding there's going to be like a handful of people. You're kind of just one of them. Yes. And some of these people are PhD doctors. Some of these people are like, you know, high level professionals. And then some of them are students like yourself. So how did you come along with, you know, becoming one of the people speaking?
So it's kind of like my dream, honestly. It's been my dream for years to do a big TED Talk. And this isn't an official big TED Talk, but TEDx is still amazing. And I did one when I was a sophomore in high school. Actually, my school did the same thing that Delaware does. They hosted a TEDx event and I was able to speak there. And so when I saw this one being advertised, I was like I knew I had to do it. I am a very passionate advocate for mental health. And so I speak at many different events and whenever I can. And so I knew that this was another chance to advocate.
Okay. And what was the process? I mean, did you just show up to the, you know, TEDx talk office and say, hey, I want to become a TEDx talker? Or was there like an application process? What happened there?
So there was a 3-step application process. The first part was just basically like what your idea is and your message. The second round was an outline. You had to make an outline of your speech, and it wasn't going to be exactly what you were going to present, but based on like your idea, And then if you made it to the third round, that was an interview. So we met with some of the people involved, like Cole Galloway and Nick Gardino. They are both, and they're both involved with TEDx at UD. And that's basically, so they said I was, there's probably around like 10 of us, and they said there were about like 150 applications, I think.
It seems like the thing you're presenting on is something that's close to you. Can you give us kind of the context behind what you're talking about? I guess first, tell us what you're talking about in the first place, and then can you give us sort of the overlying context of like what makes it so important to you?
Yeah, so the title of my talk is What If I Don't Want to Recover? Exploring the Difference Between Uncomfortable and Impossible. And what I'm talking about is specifically eating disorder recovery, but my talk can apply to anything about, like, if someone has a goal and they're not sure if they can accomplish it, it applies to them. I have been battling an eating disorder since I was around 10 years old. I've done treatment, I've done therapy, I've done all of it. And I've learned so much throughout my journey by hearing other people's stories, recovering alongside other people, and even like the different types of therapy. Like the TED talk I did in high school was on dialectical behavior therapy, because that is something I learned a lot about in treatment centers. And I just got so many perspectives, and they kind of called us like superhumans because we had so much knowledge that people don't just get. They should. That would be great if they did. But it isn't something talked about in daily life. And so throughout this journey, I just got a really big passion for helping other people. And my goal has always been to be the person for others that I know I needed when I was struggling. And I really think that lived experience is powerful because, as much as you want to understand, like, people who haven't gone through it themselves, they can't. And that's what they have to accept because they can be empathetic, but they literally cannot, they do not know what it's like. Even people who have been through similar things, you can't say you understand because you are not that person. You are not in their specific circumstance. But it's really powerful to connect with people. And sometimes that in itself is really helpful in recovery. My talk is really about, it is about saying I can't do this and what that really means, because impossible and uncomfortable are two very different things. And what's often underneath that reluctance of recovery is fear. But it's often easier to say I can't do this than it is to say I'm scared of doing this, because even society judges, we all know that in all different areas, but sometimes people get things like, oh, you're attention seeking. You want your disorder because you want attention. And no, it's not that. It's terrifying because eating disorders are coping skills. So they serve a function. You have them for a reason. And so not having that coping skill is terrifying. And it's like the eating disorder, it often becomes like your identity, again, like your safety net, your identity. You base your self-worth off of the illness. And so it doesn't, recovery doesn't always feel like freedom. It feels like a loss sometimes. And there's a lot of grieving that has to do with it, especially with like the sick body. It's really hard to leave your sick body behind sometimes. And people are sometimes like, I don't understand, or you look better recovered. That is a big thing. And they don't understand that it's not about the body, it's not about the size, it's about what it was doing for them. I often say, like, my eating disorder was my protection. I experienced a lot of bullying in school since I was young. And so, as far as like the protection goes, it helped me because I felt like if I controlled my body and food, that I would be more accepted and people won't have these negative things to say about me if I was smaller. And I mean, there's control, there's so many different functions of eating disorders, and they sometimes change over time. They can be serving multiple functions. And it's so much harder than people think to just let go of this. I like to compare it to an abusive partner or family member or friend. Like, it's not so easy to just cut them off. There's a reason you keep going back to it. And as far as like people who are going through it, and what I would say to them is, I mean, the truth is, I have a lot of friends who are going through it because I have a million friends that I met through treatment that I'm still in contact with. And I have friends from school, friends online, like people everywhere. And they know that I've been through it and I'm often a safe person. People feel like I'm a safe person for them to go to. And that really means a lot to me because that's my goal, to make sure people feel like they can come to me to be the person for them that I know I needed when I was in their place. And, I often say, like, yeah, it sucks. There's no arguing that. Sure, it will get better, but that doesn't change how much it sucks right now. It doesn't change how much it hurts right now. So it's not about telling them what to do. It's about helping them feel less alone and being there for them through the highs and the lows.
Thanks to UD junior psychology major Alexa Kate and our Israel Hale for enlightening us this week. The 2025 TEDx University of Delaware event is Wednesday, November 5th at UD's Mitchell Hall, starting at 5:30. You can learn more about it at tedx.udel.edu. And that brings the curtain down on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Israel Hale, Joe Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.